Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. On July 3rd of 1985, a summer blockbuster was released in theaters that changed popular notions of time travel and made a weird-looking car with gull-wing doors a cultural icon.
Wait a minute, Doc. Are you telling me that you built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
The way I see it, if you're going to build a time machine into a car, why not do it with some style? Besides, the stainless steel construction made the flux dispersal. Look out!
That's Michael J. Fox as Marty McFly and Christopher Lloyd as Doc in the sci-fi comedy classic Back to the Future, released 30 years ago this summer. The movie would go on to become the highest-grossing film of the year, spawn two sequels, create a billion-dollar franchise, and even inspire a musical, which opens in London next year. Cassine Gaines wrote a behind-the-scenes look at the Back to the Future trilogy. It's called We Don't Need Roads, and he's here to fill us in on the making of a pop culture icon. Cassine, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
I was a little surprised that no one had written a definitive guide to this unbelievably popular franchise. So what is it that inspired you to tackle the Back to the Future trilogy?
Well, like so many Back to the Future fans, I had been waiting for 2015 my entire life. And much like you, I was surprised that no one had tackled this trilogy and looking at not only the making of the films, but also the incredibly unusual path that Robert Zemeckis and his collaborators took to realizing this on film. And so when the 30th anniversary was coming around, I started reaching out to people, including Robert Zemeckis, Bob Gale, Leah Thompson, Christopher Lloyd, and about 50 other people, and started to collect their stories with the hope of really chronicling how they put together this film and changing what a summer blockbuster is, and what a hit film could be.
Well, in many ways, this is a story of those two Bobs, Robert Zemeckis and Robert Gale, sort of, I don't know, dilettantes in the film business that really hit it big with this one. Was there anybody that you wanted to interview who you couldn't or wish you had?
You know, I was very fortunate with this book. I spoke with almost everyone that I wanted to speak with. I think the person that I most wanted to communicate with for this book was Eric Stoltz, who was originally hired as Marty McFly before Michael J. Fox and was let go after 6 weeks of filming. But I was unable to get a hold of him. But I would be very interested to hear his perspective of what it was like working on the film, and also how not being in Back to the Future impacted his career and what his thoughts on the film were when he saw it.
Yeah, that is such an amazing story. I mean, it's hard to imagine in our minds anybody but Michael J. Fox playing Marty McFly. What was the story behind Eric Stoltz getting fired after 6 weeks?
Well, the long and short of it is that Eric Stoltz was and is a classically trained actor. He is a really nuanced actor and approached the film with a level of seriousness that Bob Zemeckis and Bob Gale really didn't need for the character of Marty McFly. And one of my favorite stories in the book actually is after the first read-through of the script, Eric Stoltz raises his hand to voice a concern, and Robert Zemeckis says, you know, what's the matter, Eric? And Eric says, well, it's so sad what happens to Marty at the end of the film. And everyone sort of looks around, and Eric goes, well, you know, like, he goes back to 1985, and his family's doing so much better, but he has this family that he doesn't know anymore. They have all of these experiences that he's not a part of, and it must be so sad for him to live the rest of his life with these strangers. And everyone was, you know, you could sort of feel the tension in the room, and everyone's sort of hoping that it wouldn't get in the way of production. And ultimately, for Eric, it was the first warning sign that things weren't going to work out for him.
Eric Stoltz was also a kind of method actor, I guess, insisted everyone call him Marty on the set.
Yes, except except for the people that worked with him on the film Mask, who then called him Rocky because that was his character name in Mask. So however you first met Eric, whichever character he was when you first met him, that's who he was for life, I guess.
Well, there's some other cast changes. Once the filming started on the sequels, Claudia Wells, she had played Marty's girlfriend, had to bow out for personal reasons. Elizabeth Shue replaced her. And Crispin Glover was invited back for the sequel, but he doesn't appear in the second film. What happened to him?
Crispin Glover has a version of the story, and virtually everyone else has a different version of the story. There was a contract negotiations that end up going south. Crispin wanted more money than he had received for the first film, which is understandable, but by all accounts, he was asking for an amount that he wasn't going to get at that point in his career, and certainly he was a little bit of a headache to work with on the first film, and so the producers weren't all that enthusiastic about paying him a lot of money to come back and be a headache for the sequels. So they ended up replacing him with a character actor named Jeffrey Weissman, which ended up resulting in a lawsuit because they put Jeffrey Weissman in Crispin Glover's old age prosthetics that they had molded for the first film and did not seek Crispin Glover's approval. They used a little bit of footage of Crispin Glover from the first film in the sequels, and essentially they were hoping to mask the fact for the audience that Crispin Glover wasn't there, and a little bit of drama came out of that.
I guess they hung him upside down during much of the second movie.
Yeah, they did. They tried to disorient the viewers, and it's funny about the Back to the Future films, especially that first sequel, part two, because they actually go back into the first film. They revisit a lot of the scenes from the first film and look at them from a different perspective. And so it was paramount that the character of George McFly look like Crispin Glover. There wasn't going to be any way that they could just recast Crispin Glover's character with a completely different person without trying to mask it in some way. So they made the best decision that they could at the time, but it ended up being a kind of a costly decision in terms of mental stress and money.
Well, obviously, with three movies, you have to spread across several years. Did they always think that it was going to be a trilogy?
No, and this is something that a lot of even diehard Back to the Future fans sort of get wrong. Bob and Bob had really no significant hits at the time of Back to the Future. They had collaborated on I Want to Hold Your Hand and Used Cars, two films that were very well received by the very few people who saw them. And Bob Zemeckis had a hit with Romancing the Stone, but by no means was Back to the Future going to be a guaranteed hit. So they had no plans of making a trilogy. They would have been happy if, you know, this film broke even. And as a result, they wrote this sort of funny here we go again ending where Marty and Doc and Jennifer get into the DeLorean and take off to 2015 so that they can solve a problem with Marty's kids. The joke being, of course, that Marty had to solve a problem with his parents, and now he's solving a problem for the next generation of McFlys. But it ended up boxing them into a corner when it came to writing those sequels because they had to start off with that premise.
30 years ago this summer, a teenager went back in time in a DeLorean. At least that's what happened in the film Back to the Future with Michael J. Fox. We're talking with Cassine Gaines. He's written a behind-the-scenes look at the making of this beloved summer blockbuster. It's so funny, Back to the Future 2, traveling forward to in time to October 2015, you know, that distant year of 2015, where self-lacing shoes and self-drying jackets are the norm, and where kids all ride around on hoverboards.
Absolutely.
Isn't that what we're doing?
You don't see hoverboards where you are? I see them all the time.
Well, one of the funniest stories in the book was that the studio got calls from people who were looking for hoverboards.
Yes. It reminds me of part of the charm of these films is that so much was done practically. You know, when you see the DeLorean flying, they actually built a DeLorean out of fiberglass, and so they were able to put actors into it and lower it down on a crane. The hoverboards were done practically as well as optically. It's unlike a summer blockbuster today. If you see Jurassic World, so much of that is CGI, of course. Because so many of the props were practical, the actors could handle them, you could see weight to these objects. A lot of people watching in theaters believed that these props really existed, and that cars really could fly and that boards really could hover. And so not only kids, but even parents were calling up the studio and believing that what they had seen was real.
There's so many funny parts of this. I mean, I think, would we even know what a DeLorean was as a car if it weren't for Back to the Future?
No, and the car wasn't even in production. John DeLorean was already going through his legal troubles. The company was bankrupt. There are very few DeLoreans that were made, about 10,000 or so. And so by the time the movie came out, you couldn't even get a DeLorean, which is why they're sort of so coveted by Back to the Future enthusiasts.
But it's not just the diehard enthusiasts. This movie really shook up the culture in some level. Why do you think it hit so big and why it's had such a lasting impact?
I think it starts with the fact that Back to the Future is truly one of the most creative stories. It's so simple. You know, it's one of those things where there must have been hundreds, millions of people going, why didn't I think of this story? A teenager accidentally goes back in time, meets his parents as teenagers, affects his parents' meeting. It's a brilliant idea. And the other thing is that I think this idea of time travel is so universal for people. You know, this idea that a moment can change your life so significantly, and that if you could go back in time, you could change that one thing you said to your boss that got you fired, or that one argument you had with, you know, your grandma that you didn't get a chance to apologize for, or something like that. Back to the Future really points towards the importance of moments and relationships and really treasuring the time that you have. And I think that has resonated with people over the last 30 years.
Well, Kasin, happy 30th anniversary to you, and thanks so much.
Thank you.
Kasin Gaines, author of We Don't Need Roads, The Making of the Back to the Future Trilogy. He's also written inside looks for Pee-wee's Playhouse and a behind-the-scenes look at A Christmas Story. You'll find links to all of those at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.